Hi there, and welcome to Open Mic here on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're visiting with Steve Young, a retired professor from Morehead State University and a local activist. And we're going to talk a little bit about how things are working in Washington, D.C. Steve, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me.
Now, one of the things that we wanted to talk about, there's a lot going on in Washington, D.C. right now. We just had a presidential election. There's an inauguration coming up. There was a runoff in Georgia earlier this week. And it seems like a lot of things are up in the air. But one of the things that, regardless of what happens by the end of the month, one of the things that we want to focus on is really how things work with the Electoral College and presidential elections. Presidential elections happen every 4 years, as everyone knows, and in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion about the popular vote versus the Electoral College. And some people just don't really understand exactly how it works. So to start with, tell me a little bit about what is the Electoral College.
Well, the Electoral College was created when the Founding Fathers could not agree on how the president should be elected. One group wanted to elect by popular vote, while the other group wanted a small elite group like the House of Representatives to select our leader. Now, as a compromise, the Electoral College was created, a system in which the people would vote for president, but state by state, an elite group of electors could, if deemed necessary, override the popular vote. Now, the process was tweaked in the 12th Amendment, and we've been using it ever since. You can see the controversy it's causing in the current election as challenge after challenge continues to confuse and confound the American public.
And I feel like that's kind of a lot of what's happening is a lot of people are confused by the whole process. But in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion about getting rid of the Electoral College and doing what is called the National Popular Vote. That's a proposal that people are discussing. I wouldn't say that it's on the table, but maybe in the same room. And tell me a little bit about what that proposal entails.
Well, the national popular vote is a system which provides the most direct and non-manipulative means of providing the people of the United States the means of choosing their president by direct vote. Works very simply by a joint resolution of Kentucky's and other states' legislatures. Each state agrees to withhold the awarding of its electoral votes until all votes across the nation have been counted and verified. Now, at that point, each state's total electoral votes will be awarded to the candidate who has received the most votes nationwide. That's the way it works.
Now, as of right now, the Electoral College means that someone can win the popular vote but lose the Electoral College vote. And that, I remember when the first time that I was aware of politics, I guess, and saw that happened was back when George W. Bush won, I believe was the first. Did that happen when he won with Al Gore?
In 2000, the infamous hanging chads in Florida that most of us remember, or at least they're old enough to remember. But it's happened, of course, again. It happened in 2016. Donald Trump lost the popular vote, but won the Electoral College and was indeed elected president.
And I kind of feel like that's what spurned, I mean, that was 21 years ago now, and still we're discussing on whether or not the Electoral College versus the popular vote proposal, that's still a conversation that's being had. I mean, 20 years is a long time to have a conversation.
Well, it's been around actually since the Constitution was written. The Electoral College was a part of the original Constitution. It was amended in the 12th Amendment, of course. It was tweaked, I should say, in the 12th Amendment. But we've had the Electoral College for a long time now, and it simply has not worked very well.
Now, why do you think that the Electoral College has failed the nation, and what is it that's so wrong with it?
Well, there are several reasons. We could be here all day talking about what's wrong with the Electoral College, but among the reasons is that the Electoral College has no less than five times caused to be elected a president who received a minority of votes from the American people, and twice it threw the election into the House of Representatives. Now, it may be argued that it hasn't happened often. The fact that it's happened at all is intolerable, let alone the fact that it's happened twice in the last 20 years. Two of our last four presidents were elected by a minority of the people, or more correctly, by a system which allows a minority to make that choice. It's argued that both times in recent history, it's been a Republican who's benefited. Therefore, Republicans should oppose the proposal. But even a cursory analysis of the process reveals that both candidates being Republicans is a coincidence, and that the next time it occurs, and it will, the recipient of this unpredictable and undemocratic system may well be a Democrat. An examination of the 2004 presidential election reveals that John Kerry lost the popular vote, but came very close to winning the Electoral College and becoming president. A few thousand votes in a couple of key states would have tipped the election in his favor. A close call, but one in which it was the Democrat who was almost swept into office by this skewed system. And what else is wrong with the Electoral College? Well, it's antiquated, for one. The world of the late 1700s was far different than today. Founding fathers chose to take the election of president out of the hands of the people for two reasons. It was felt that most of the people were living on farms widely separated from centers of government and commerce, and that these isolated tobacco, corn, and cotton farmers were not well informed about the issues of the day. These same citizens were also deemed ignorant, as most had little, if any, formal education. As such, they were thought incapable of wisely choosing a national leader. Now, while there may have been some element of truth to the argument in the 1700s, it's utterly absurd today. Speedy travel by means never dreamed of by the founding fathers, and instant communication, which literally surrounds us 24 hours a day, along with compulsory education and literacy at its highest levels ever, ensures that any citizen who wants to be informed as to the issues and candidates can be. Which leads us to the next objection to the Electoral College: elitism. Now, while the Electoral College was billed as a compromise between direct popular vote and selection by the House of Representatives, it actually serves as an insulator to remove the people from the office as far as possible. Feeling the people inferior in choosing a leader, the small, educated, and wealthy elite framed the Constitution to provide a means of correcting, if you will, the people's choice. Not only may the citizens of our nation not directly choose their national leader, they must settle for selecting intermediaries, considered better educated and informed, who would make that decision for them, even to the degree of thwarting the will of the people by having the power to overturn the people's choice. Now, this elitism continues today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with you there.
When we step into the voting booth, we are choosing not a candidate, as you might think, but a slate of electors. Sometimes their name appears on the ballot, but oftentimes not. But it matters not, because they're people we don't know and have never heard of, who will decide for us who should be president. One insult is that these electors are not necessarily well-educated nor better informed on the issues and candidates. Today, they're largely party faithful, chosen by the political parties who have contributed money and effort to their political party and are appointed electors as a feather in their cap for simply being good little soldiers and towing the party line. These, not the people, will choose our president under the Electoral College. Perhaps the ultimate insult to America's citizens is that these electors, chosen to cast ballots for a particular candidate based upon the will of the people in a particular state, are free to vote for whomever they choose. In other words, they may ignore the wishes of the people of that state and cast their ballots for anyone they choose. Anybody want to vote for Alfred E. Newman?
Now I know that's not something that has happened in recent memory. Generally speaking, they do go along with the states, whatever their state has chosen. But I feel like, and going back just a little bit to what you said about being informed, although the pandemic has caused innumerable terrible things to happen within the United States, there's a whole lot of problems, a whole lot of inequity, a whole lot of issues that have been highlighted because of the pandemic. One of the things that the pandemic did allow for was for a more informed voting base. People suddenly had more time on their hands in order to research the candidates. A vast majority of the citizens of the country have access to some kind of device in which they could do research if they so wanted to do so. And I think that allowed time, and of course the platforms, people who were able to put in their talking points during the election, before the election happened, before, if you wanted to know, to go to a rally or a stump speech or something in order to figure out what a candidate stood for, you had to be present, and the World Wide Web, forced people, well, because of the pandemic, people used the World Wide Web more to get online and put their platform out there. And, if I had to work during the day and I missed the stump speech, I could watch the recorded video very easily and kind of go back. And I think a lot more people are paying attention this time.
Well, as I say, it's simply an argument that perhaps made a little bit of sense back in the 1700s, but certainly makes no sense today. As I say, we are absolutely surrounded with information. In fact, I think there are times when all of us feel a little bit overwhelmed with the amount of information that we're bombarded with, if you will. To say that we have an uninformed electorate is just it's just not a valid argument to make at all.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick break here on Open Mic. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we take you to Los Angeles, a city that sits on the largest urban oil field in the country. The story of one young Latina who decides to take on the powerful oil industry.
I feel like they don't see me as the threat, but I know that isn't true, and they'll just have to find that out on their own.
That's this week on Latino USA. Saturday mornings at 7 on WMKY at 90.3 FM.
And we're back here on Open Mic here at Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're talking with Steve Young about the Electoral College and whether it is something that should be considered out the door, and the national popular vote proposal is what we're discussing today. Now, Steve, before we get into that a little more, I do want to say that defenders of the Electoral College say that the direct popular vote really would give too much power to the most populous states. We hear that argument often. There are a whole lot of people centered in these big American cities, and that really affects things as far as voting goes. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's true. The defenders of the Electoral College keep insisting that a direct popular vote system for president will result in populous states and cities controlling future elections. That is a myth, an absolute myth. In fact, actually, the opposite is true. It's the Electoral College that gives more power to populous states than would a direct popular vote. And here's why. Everyone points to California with its 55 electoral votes. So let's compare not hypothetical or theoretical possibilities, but real voting results from the 2016 election, the last election for which we have complete data. Since there are 270 electoral votes needed to win the presidency, we need only divide California's 55 electoral votes by the 270 needed to win, and we determined that winning California put Hillary Clinton in that 2016 election 20% of the way to victory. Now, forget the other 49 states. just California gave her one-fifth of all the votes she needed to win. And you say a popular vote would give undue power to such states? Let's examine some actual numbers from the election. If you combine the total votes cast nationwide for Clinton and Trump, you get 128.8 million votes. Divide by two and you have the number of votes needed to win. That means that if you had been using direct popular voting, it would have taken 64.4 million votes, plus one, of course, to win. Clinton and winning California got 7.3 million votes. Do the math, and it means that by popular vote, California would have given her only 11.3% of the votes needed to win. The influence of California just dropped almost in half. Why? Because the Electoral College is a winner-take-all system. You can win a state by just one vote, yet receive 100% of the electoral votes, as if every single voter in the state had voted only for the winner. It's a skewed system, and it will indeed always give an inflated sense of proportion to populous states. Now, under the Electoral College, you can win just 11 states and win the election, and that's not a misstatement. Win the right 11 states, the ones with the most electoral votes, and you can write off the other 39 as being irrelevant. Does this begin to look a little cockeyed? Now, take the same 11 states and let's add up their actual vote in the 2016 election. These 11 states cast a total of 36.3 million votes for Clinton. Again, do the math and you find that instead of winning the entire election, they would have put her only 56% of the way to victory. In other words, she would have had to have had help from a lot of other states in order to win. Now, Clinton won only four of the 11 most populous states, but you can compute the figures for Trump and he fares only a little better. Those top 11 states will, under direct popular vote, simply not put you over the top. They do not have nearly the power that they had under the Electoral College system.
Now, what about the places with large cities? I mean, here in Kentucky, I remember back when during the Democratic primary for governor, you know, everybody around here was watching that very closely between Andy Beshear and Rocky Adkins, who served this region for a very long time. People were watching that very closely, and everything looked to be in Rocky Adkins' favor until the big cities hit. Jefferson County changed everything. And how does that apply when we're talking about the presidential election with states that have a big city? Is it disproportionate?
Well, all right, let's talk about the most populous cities. Let's go back to the 2016 election. Clinton won 9 of the 10 most populous cities, yet her vote totals for all 10 cities was only 13.6 million votes, which would have given her only 21% of the votes necessary to achieve victory. So add up the 10 most populous cities, and they get you only one-fifth of the way to a win. Of course, the cities are important, but you must campaign outside the cities as well if you want to win by popular vote. Can and do cities dominate rural areas in voting? Absolutely not. Large cities will not dominate a national popular vote. They're simply not as large as some people think compared to the entire population of the country. Take the 100 largest cities in the United States. They contain just one-sixth of the U.S. population, about 16%, and they tend to vote Democratic. Now, the rural areas, these are the areas apart from the cities. They contain one-sixth of the U.S. population, and they tend to vote Republican. That is, the biggest cities are precisely balanced out by rural areas in terms of population and partisan composition. The remaining two-thirds of the U.S. population live in what are called metropolitan statistical areas, outside the central city, but not considered rural. That is suburban areas, if you will. And they are evenly divided politically. So with every vote important, it becomes imperative that under the popular vote system, candidates are going to have to campaign virtually everywhere. Unlike the current Electoral College system, where only certain states and certain areas get all the attention.
Now, obviously, you know, the national popular vote proposal is one that gets discussed a lot. But are there other ideas on how to change the Electoral College or fix it?
Well, yeah, there are currently four proposed fixes to the Electoral College. One is a constitutional amendment. Now, this approach would simply propose an amendment which would excise the Electoral College altogether and replace it with direct popular vote. While this may be the ideal solution, it's certainly not the most practical. Constitutional amendments take years. Think about the 19th Amendment, how long it took women to get the vote. And how about the ERA, which has yet to be ratified? Plus, amendments are very expensive, they're time-consuming, and they require great expenditures of energy. Another proposed fix, if you will, is to keep the Electoral College, but since the Constitution does not specify how the electoral votes will be allocated, it leaves that decision to the states. So this plan calls for the electoral votes in each state to be awarded on the basis of percentage of the vote, which each candidate received. That is, if a candidate receives 65% of the popular vote in that state, he or she would receive 65% of the electoral votes. This would mean, however, splitting electoral votes. But how far do you carry the decimal places? Rounding off puts you back in the position of being not quite accurate and could tip things in a very close election. This plan also keeps virtually all of the disadvantages of the current Electoral College. That is, the power remains in the hands of the Electoral College electors and not the people. Then a third system keeps the Electoral College, but this plan calls for using the congressional districts in the state as determiners of where the electoral votes go. Maine and Nebraska use a variation of this plan. If Kentucky were to use this plan, each of our six congressional districts would have one electoral vote, plus the other two votes would go to the candidate who received the most votes statewide. Again, sounds reasonable, but can you imagine the gerrymandering which would run rampant in redistricting to ensure a Democratic or a Republican district? Now the presidential race would be in the hands of local and state politicians, not people. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, finally, you have the national popular vote proposal, which I've already described. It contains none of the disadvantages of the other plans. That is, it does not require a constitutional amendment, does not require apportionment or splitting of electoral votes, avoids gerrymandering, and most of all, it places the selection of a national president in the hands of the people, not in the hands of state manipulators. All that would be required in Kentucky is a resolution adopted in both houses of the state legislature stating that Kentucky will withhold its 8 electoral votes until the national vote has been tabulated and certified. And at that point, all 8 of Kentucky's electoral votes shall be cast for the candidate who received the most votes nationwide. Now, this plan keeps the Electoral College, thereby avoiding a constitutional amendment. But instead of the Electoral College choosing our president, it simply becomes a rubber stamp of approval upon the choice made by the people.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that this is a very complex issue. This is something a lot of people have done a lot of research on. But where can our listeners find some more information or connect with people who are having this kind of conversation?
Well, a website that I would like to recommend to everyone is nationalpopularvote.com. Those are all lowercase, if you will, nationalpopularvote.com. And there you'll find several discussions on the Electoral College itself. Plus, you'll find much more information on the national popular vote proposal. And as I say, I would encourage you not to take my word for it, but to visit that site and look. And I think you will come away agreeing that we certainly need some radical change in the Electoral College.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have here on Open Mic. Steve Young, retired professor and local activist, I really appreciate you spending the time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Open Mic. Our show is produced by Greg Jenkins, and our theme music is Turtle in the Creek, composed by Galen Green and performed by The Wooks. Produced by Moorhead State Public Radio with the generous support of listeners just like you. We'll see you next Friday.